KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. I'll be back in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good evening to you. Good day to you. Good morning, whoever you might be, wherever you might be. Welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. Thanks to all of you for listening to the program and for supporting KOPN Community Radio here in Mid-Missouri and worldwide. Thanks to Corey and all the folks doing it up this evening on KOPN before me. Monday nights are awesome here on KOPN, and the awesomeness continues. I'll be here with you for the next 3 hours, and an interesting 3 hours it should be. We're going to start things right off the bat with tonight's guest. We have a little bit of a, actually, I should be honest about it. It's a big change of plans. We were expecting to have Russell Means on the air with us tonight. Of course, Russell was scheduled to be on the program to talk tonight about some of the things that are happening in Lakota country, the Lakota Nation. And we have a little bit of a change of plan because his health is not particularly good tonight. And we have a gentleman whose name is Jerry Collett, who's going to be joining us. And I don't know a lot about Jerry, but we'll find out in a few minutes. We will get right to Jerry and say hello and find out how we might proceed tonight. But I'm certain that that Russell would have chosen him wisely, and we'll find out right now. So, Jerry Collett, hello. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, Mike. It's actually pronounced Collett.
Collett, okay. Jerry Collett.
Yes, on the second syllable.
All right. Well, Jerry Collett, I would normally ask the person who was scheduled to be interviewed with me a little bit about themselves and why the folks that are listening should be interested in what they had to say, so I'm going to do the same with you, and let's just pretend that we had scheduled to talk with you tonight, and we'll move forward in that manner, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in this whole Lakota business before we even tell people what's going on.
Well, I'm a long-term libertarian activist. I don't go back quite as far as Russell. Those of you who may know about one of the candidates running for president right now, Ron Paul actually got the Libertarian nomination in 1988, but the person who came in second by one vote was Russell Means. So Russell's also a pretty long-term Libertarian activist.
Right.
I didn't get involved with the Libertarians until after the Berlin Wall came down. Prior to that, I really didn't believe any individual could make a difference. When I saw the Berlin Wall come down, I started to look at it and say, you know, maybe we can make a difference. And I became politically active and got pretty active in my local Libertarian Party. I was living in California at the time and then involved in the state party, and then kind of got a little fed up with it, moved to the East Coast. But when Ron Paul got activated, I got involved in that campaign, and I still am the manager of the legal team for the Ron Paul blimp.
Yeah, I've seen it. I love it, actually. I remember I saw it flying over some town in Texas, I think, if I remember right.
Oh, it's been flying all over the place and getting a tremendous amount of publicity. But besides the blimp itself, is the whole creative way that we were able to structure the way we did it. NPR's on the media call it a loophole in campaign finance reform law big enough to fly the Ron Paul blimp through.
There you go. That's the kind of press we're looking for, right?
That is the kind of press we're looking for sure.
Well, I'm a fan of Ron Paul for sure. I've been in, you know, many conversations about, you know, the upcoming elections and this and that over the last who knows how many months, but I don't see another alternative, frankly, and you know, there are certainly positions of his that are perhaps you know, not particularly agreeable to some folks, but for me, I'm looking for someone, number one, that's going to tell the truth. And I know that, that Ron Paul, for the most part, speaks the truth, and you can look at his congressional record and look at the way he votes and the people that he hangs around with and his advisors and this sort of thing, and you can get a pretty good feel for who he is. And I think he's the only one, at least out there, that I've a viable candidate that can actually raise money, and he's proved that he can do that, you know, who's actually, you know, walking the talk.
Well, I thought so, too, and I thought that was the most important game in town until I found out about what Russell was doing here in Lakota. And as you can imagine, as a person who believed in freedom, I was a little unhappy with the way things were in the United States. But at the same time, like, where else are you going to go? I mean, you know, the rest of the world isn't that free either. And so I never left the United States. Well, I left for visits, but as far as I never moved anywhere else. But now that I'm here in Lakota, I actually believe I'm in an even freer place than the United States. And as much as I like libertarian freedom-thinking philosophy, the Lakota people naturally have it way, way beyond even what the libertarians have. And they've been doing it naturally for thousands of years, even under the oppression of the colonizers.
Yeah, it's an idea that goes quite a ways back. There are a number of Native people here in the North American continent, you know, the Iroquois in particular, I think about the American Constitution, the United States Constitution was established and modeled in large part on the Iroquois Federation's, you know, sort of style of government and their actual, you know, to the detail, actually.
Yes.
So,
and
anyway,
they've been doing
well,
it for thousands of years.
Right. Well, we're very interested in what's going on up there, and a lot of people are, and there's a lot of questions. And so I think what I'd like to ask, and, you know, you just tell me if it's a question that you're, you know, prepared to or qualified to answer, and if not, that's no problem. We just move to something else, okay?
Sure.
I don't say that with any malice. I'm just not familiar with you, and I'm just not sure what you know where we might actually end up. So that's all, okay?
Yeah. Well, I'll do my. Believe me, if I don't know, I'll say I don't know.
Okay. All right. So first of all, for people to whom this material is new, the Lakota Nation. First of all, let's talk about the history, and even pre-colonial, if you'd like. And sort of move toward where we are today, because I think for the most part people think, well, it's just a reservation up there in South Dakota somewhere, just like there's one down in Hopi Land, just like there's a bunch of them on the West Coast and the East Coast and all over the place, and they just sort of do their own thing there, but they're basically, you know, bound by and to the U.S. Constitution.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I just wrote a thing up that I think just went up on the internet today. If you go to the website, which is republicoflakota.com, although if you spell it the white man way and put Republic of Lakota without the H, it'll point you to the right spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a link up along the top menu there that says portfolio. There's kind of a little thumbnail summary of some of the history of the Lakota people, and it's not very long. There's probably only about 6 points there. But in essence, in the 1700s and prior, the Lakota people lived quite well with very little government of any kind. Even the whole concept of a chief, you know, this is a white man's concept mm-hmm. that's been imposed upon them. The white man showed up and said, "Who's your chief?" They kind of looked at each other and said, "Huh?" Because, you know, free people don't need bosses. Mm-hmm. They just do what they do. And so, you know, they kind of like point to somebody, "Oh, you talk to him, you know, he'll talk to you." And that was kind of how they evolved the chief system. But prior to that, they didn't even really have chiefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They did have medicine men, of course.
Sure.
Sitting Bull was actually a medicine man, not a chief. And then, you know, they did a pretty good job of getting along with themselves and resolving their issues. Not that they didn't have war sometimes, but, you know, they were not the bloody savages that, you know, they were painted in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1803, the United States purchased the Louisiana Purchase, although under international law, they didn't really purchase all of that land. What they really purchased from France was a non-compete clause from France, that France wasn't going to go in there and try to make deals with the Indians.
Hmm.
But the United States recognized in Article 5, I believe, of that Louisiana Purchase Treaty that they would respect and protect the liberty, the property rights, and the religious freedoms of the inhabitants of that area.
Hmm.
And so that meant in order to occupy any of the areas that they had to come to some kind of deals with the local inhabitants.
Hmm.
And over the next course of the years, up into 1868, they made numerous treaties with the Lakota people. Most of them were done under the name of the Sioux Nation. And you'll never believe this, Mike, but the United States actually breached a lot of them. And we've been finding out since then that they've actually breached some with a whole bunch of the other Indian tribes. Can you imagine that?
Go figure, huh?
Yes. And since then, there's just been, you know, more and more and more colonization. And pretty much from what I'm learning now as I've been here, it's been a real attempt at genocide directly or indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
And the policies, as you look back, they could have had no other intent other than to wipe these people out and take their land.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a treaty is basically like a contract. I mean, if we make a deal and I say, Mike, I'm going to pay you $50 to mow my lawn every week, and I stop paying you the $50.
It costs you at least $100.
All right, well, either way, you know, whatever we make, if it was $100, if I stop paying you whatever we agree to, obviously you're not on the hook to keep doing your part. Mm-hmm. If one side breaches, the other side gets to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happens with the treaties. They're basically the same fundamental ways of basic contract law, because that's what they are as a contract. If one side breaches, the other side gets to opt out.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the Lakota people, actually, let me back up. In 1974, there was a huge international treaty conference here in on the Standing Rock Reservation. Over 5,000 Lakota people came, and Indians came from all over the world. But there were 5,000 Lakota people here because it was on a Lakota reservation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these were elders, and they weren't just your ordinary elders. If you think about the time of that, these were people who were born to parents, who were raised by parents who were born free. A lot of them didn't go to school. A lot of them had never spoken English, or if they did, you know, they still thought in Lakota.
Mm-hmm.
They had an entirely different mindset than Lakota, who had been raised the white man way.
Mm-hmm.
And they set out some mandates for the people who were there. At the time, Russell was considered young. He was only in his 30s then. And the mandates were two. One was to get the rights of indigenous people recognized by the international community, and two was sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Number one just got achieved in September of 2007. The United Nations passed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And that finally happened after 33 years from that international treaty conference, and there was a lot of work went into that. There was an office opened across the United Nations, and people went and had conventions in Geneva, and lots of wooing, and of course, you know, the governments resisted this. In fact, on this particular convention, there were four governments who didn't vote for it. All the other governments of the world supported it. The four that didn't, United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And what do they all have in common, of course, is they're all colonizing countries that have colonized and pushed out the local indigenous people.
What about the people that are telling me that the UN is bunk and it doesn't matter what the UN says because it's just a bunch of tin pot dictators anyway that never get anything done if it's not for their own benefit?
Well, you know, there is a certain truth to that. But at the same time, there is a certain amount of public opinion that they do show.
Yeah, in other words, just the fact that it's been recognized and it's on the news or whatever may have a psychological effect on the public, yeah.
It does, you know? And, you know, if you look back at the history, for example, of how the British left India, they
destroyed.
Well, yes, but they also just left. I mean, you know, if you saw the Gandhi movie,
the viceroy came
to India and he had a meeting with Gandhi when he first arrived, and he said, well, do you actually expect the British to just pack up and go home? And Gandhi said, yes, you will. That's exactly what you'll do. And sure enough, they did. But why did they do that? Because the British public opinion got to the point where the British people said, we don't want our government oppressing these people anymore like this in our name.
Mm-hmm.
And we expect the American people will have that same realization with respect to the Lakota and other indigenous people, but it's not probably going to happen overnight.
You know, it's interesting that I'm thinking just right now about this situation in Gaza and on the Egyptian border, where they're just sort of threw down the gauntlet and blasted through to get the things that they needed and this and that. And I mean, there's two sides to all these arguments. Some people say, oh my God, now they're going to get weapons in Egypt. But regardless, it sort of reminds me of what the Israelis are sort of saying. They're saying, like, we're just done with this place. We're just going to, like, pack up and leave, essentially, is one of the lines that's coming out of the Israeli hierarchy. So, I mean, who knows?
All over the world, the trend is for colonizing countries to be withdrawing from their territories and turning sovereignty back over to the indigenous people.
Mm.
Most of the European powers have done it throughout the world.
Big story in Australia with the Maori people. And
the Maori people even happening in Australia. And, of course, you know, the United States has already given sovereignty back to four places now. First one was the, it may even be more than four, there's four that I'm aware of. First one being the Philippines, which they gave their sovereignty back in 1946. And then in the 80s, there were two of the trust territories of the Pacific. And
it's more like they recognize their sovereignty. They can't give it back because it was not
theirs.
That's
true, yeah. Well, they walked out. You're right. They can't really, but they recognized it again. You're absolutely right. In fact, there was a special letter from the president of the Mariana Islands saying, you know, listen, you know, they didn't have anything to give back.
Right.
We always had it. So you're right on that.
Okay, all right. So who else, though, is involved in that? It's happened with how many different nations?
The first one was the Philippines.
Right.
Then there was, the Mariana Islands and the Marshall Islands. Mm. Or actually, no, Micronesia and the Marshall Islands happened together.
Huh.
The Mariana Islands actually decided to stay, at least for now.
Uh-huh.
And then Palau didn't happen until about 10 years later. And so there are three now of those trust territories of the Pacific are now sovereign nations, and they've done it on what's called a compact of free association, where the United States, for example, still has some military bases there, and they pay rent for them. And so, you know, and that would probably be the kind of thing that would happen here for several reasons. First of all, you know, the United States probably is going to still want a military base here, and we probably aren't going to want to have our own military. Just doesn't make sense to have one. I don't think we have to worry about being bombed by the United States or Canada, and I don't think they're going to let anybody else come through. And also with respect to collecting rent, I mean, one of the problems we have here is the United States has done a tremendously successful job of training the Lakota people to be dependent.
Mm.
And to just suddenly cut them loose after years of that browbeating into dependency would not be very kind.
Hmm.
And so there needs to be, you know, some kind of transition to get them, you know, back to being more freestanding again like they were long before the United States showed up.
Hmm. That's an interesting topic because a lot of what happened in the colonizational, you know, the tactics of not just the U.S. government, but colonizing powers in general, imperial powers in general, a lot of that was sort of perfected or sort of honed, refined on indigenous people around the world. But now it's been sort of brought home to the rest of us.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the new Indians, you know, of rural America are the family farmer and the rancher and the, you know, the free thinker and the gay guy in Winnipeg or, you know, whoever, people who are different, you know.
Oh, and now they're trying to export it. I mean, you know, the newest reservation is Iraq.
Mm.
And, you know, just like they did in the United States, is they, you know, bought off different of the people in the tribes to get them to sell their people out. That's what they're doing over there in Iraq now, is they're paying off these various leaders huge amounts of money to sell out their people. And, you know, it's just the same tactic. You know, we're the last colonizing country. I see, when I say we, I'm talking about the United States because, mm-hmm. of course, you know, I still sometimes think I'm still one of you guys, even though I moved here. But the United States is the last colonizing country, and they're still doing it. You know, they're trying to colonize Afghanistan, failing pretty miserably, trying to colonize Iraq, actually having maybe a little more success, but a long-term success. I mean, colonization just doesn't work. It's
right.
not sustainable,
right,
and eventually it fails.
All right. I tell you what, let's take a break here. We're close to the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a nice long break. I've got a couple of things I've got to do here in the studio. We'll have about 7 minutes, okay?
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and talk a little bit more because I want to explain now to people exactly what's happening up there in Lakota country and let people know the details and the legal status of what's happening. So we'll talk more a little bit in just a few minutes, okay, Jerry?
Sounds great, Mike.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. And Jerry, for the listeners, what is your title or position or representative of Russell? I'm not even sure.
I am the interim attorney general for the provisional government, and we can get into that in more detail when we come back, unless you want to...
No, that's a good little cliffhanger, because obviously there's going to have to be some method of governance, so you've obviously thought about that.
Yes.
All right, we'll be back in a little bit. We'll talk more, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody, Jerry Collette, and he's one of the people that's involved in this story up there in Lakota country, South Dakota, Nebraska, and, well, I don't know where else it stretches into, but I think five different states, actually. So, anyway, we'll get back with Jerry in just a few minutes. In the meantime, we'll listen to a little bit more music here. You're hearing music, by the way, tonight from a CD that's called Earth Spirit, and it is a collection of songs and dances of Native American Indians, and it is performed by Christian Bollmann and the Oberton Corps from, I think, Dusseldorf, believe it or not, in Germany. And if you all remember, there was a wonderful woman who was on the program, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, maybe longer, 2 years, but her name is Doro Meinke, and we did a program on male initiation, and she introduced me to Christian Bollmann and sent me the CD a while back, and it was very appropriate, I thought, for tonight's program. So, like I said, we'll hear another one from that right now. This one is called The River is Flowing. Certainly it is, and all of them are. And we'll talk more with Jerry Collett about the rivers that are flowing up there in Lakota country in just a few minutes. Okay, it's Mike and this is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM on the web, KOPN.org. And my website, of course, www.mikehagan.com. And the website for information on what's happening with the Lakota people is www. How many W's do you have to say? Republic of Lakota, with an H at the end, republicoflakota.com. Back in just a few minutes. Christian Bollmann in the Oberton Chor. That means the Oberton Choir, German for that, of course. And you're listening to it here on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and it's a pleasure to be with you all tonight. It is about 12:34. Well, if we were in the Eastern time zone, but we're not. So it's 11:34 here in Mid-Missouri. And 10:34, I think, in South Dakota, where we're talking to Jerry Collett. Jerry, you're in South Dakota, right?
Well, the South Dakota used to be the permanent area, and the state government hasn't left yet. So by some definitions, we're in South Dakota, but we are now in Lakota.
Okay. And we should be referring to the name of the nation as Lakota, just as we would call it Germany or France or whatever.
Yes. I mean, we officially, it's the Republic of Lakota,
but
there's lots of countries that have those kind of, other titles. But yeah, you just refer it to the short name.
Okay, well, that's a good sort of lead into what's going on up there. Apparently, in December, mid-December, I guess about the 17th or whatever, there was a press release and a notification of the U.S. government and a press conference and all this that the Lakota Nation was unilaterally withdrawing from all agreements and treaties, etc., between the USA and the Lakota people. This is where this story gets interesting, and a lot of people are saying, well, please explain it to us, and I'd like you to just sort of tell the story about what's going on and how we should be taking the whole thing.
Well, we did announce on, as you say, the 17th of December, Russell and the Lakota Freedom Delegation went to the State Department and presented the notice of withdrawal along with a portfolio of quite a few documents, and clearly showed that we are clearly within our rights to do that. The United States government hasn't left yet, though. Even though they've been politely asked to leave, we currently see them as trespassers here in our country. Technically, so are all the people living here, but we're not treating them that way. We're taking the premise that they really didn't have anything to do with the horrible acts that the government did, and we're going to work out an arrangement with them that we think they're going to actually like living in Lakota better than they like living in the United States, because it'll be much freer. Right now, Mike, in the United States, if you wanted to have somebody cut your hair or polish your nails or even just take a burr off the end of your nails, they need to have a license. Everything is just getting so micromanaged and big government oriented, whereas here in Lakota, people are going to be free. It's just like they were long before the white man ever showed up. The white man actually used to think free when they founded this country, but, of course, there was a unspoken rule that, that meant they were also free to steal Indian land. But for the most part, they did have a lot of the right values of freedom, but they've lost it. And the Lakota people really have always had it. So it'll be much freer for the people that are living here, and we think that they'll like it. We've already had a refugee problem or situation. For years, this area had what would be referred to as a brain drain. Every generation, the people that were pretty bright would go away to school and not come back and go get jobs elsewhere, not only from the reservation, but even from white society. And since we have reasserted our sovereignty, the phones have been ringing off the hook. We've been getting emails and even snail mails from people wanting to come here and be part of what we're doing, and these are not, like renegades. These are bright, professional people, mostly Americans, some from other parts of the world, some skilled workers. We had a farmer call recently, wants to come and bring all his animals, and, people who want to be free, recognize freedom, and come, plus investors. We had so many calls from investors who want to invest. Money likes to go where it's free.
Right, okay.
So we think the quality of life will be far better for the people here, including the people who are Americans.
All right. Now, let's talk about support and how much support there is. In other words, there's got to be a percentage of the population that is being represented by Russell and Phyllis And I don't have the web set up right now, but the other two mm-hmm. people, but it, you know, but they're the people who are essentially behind this idea. What about the people who disagree and say, well, you know, we're Lakota, but Russell doesn't represent me.
Mm-hmm.
How is that being handled? And I guess how much support do you have?
Well, I guess probably the best analogy that I could give you is one that we all learned being raised in American schools. You know, when the colonists here in the United States first declared their independence, the average person who was here, A, didn't know, and the few who do didn't care. They were busy farming, fishing, trading, whatever they were doing. And then there was a whole bunch of people who were working for the British Crown, like the colonial governors and their staff. Well, obviously, they were opposed to it and would say, huh, you know, George Washington and those guys don't represent us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that would be what the Crown governor of Virginia would have said. And just like the people who were working for the tribal governments. You know, the tribal governments have this illusion that they represent the tribes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they represent the tribes sort of in the same way the colonial governor of Virginia represented the people living in Virginia. He really represented the Crown. And what the administrators here have is the right of self-administration, but not self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
They get to administer Washington policies, but that's not real freedom.
Right.
So, yeah, there's certainly a lot more of them proportionally than there were in the United States when the United States declared its independence. And most of the people who are working here are working in one way or shape or form for the BIA or the IHS. And so there's certainly a huge amount of those, and then they have friends and family, and they're certainly resistant, but they're coming around.
Mm-hmm.
There was a meeting, I think 2 weeks ago. Well, first of all, we've been going around to the various reservations and talking to people, and the support just keeps building. But there was a meeting that we didn't even go to, but we heard about it. It was the tribal chair people from the various reservations, and these are people who are the administrators of Washington policy, and yet they had a meeting with the BIA. Two of the tribal chair spoke up in favor of the sovereignty, and the third one, who's been opposed to Russell for years, never mentioned Russell's name, but he stood up, looked at the superintendent of the BIA, and said, this is our land, it always has been. Mm-hmm. When are you leaving, and what are your plans to get out of here?
Mm-hmm.
And just today, there's a huge meeting over at the casino here. You might have been aware that there's been this idea that the path to success for the Indians
right.
is going to be casinos, but
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
you know, casinos are zero-sum game. They don't really produce anything.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, there is a casino here on the reservation. It's a small one, and there is a meeting over there that's going on for 3 days. Today, basically, the local people are there kind of putting together an agenda. Of course, it was already pre-printed. Tomorrow is a meeting with the BIA, and then the following day is when the bigwigs from Washington, including the senators and the congressmen, come. But it's all designed to promote the BIA policies. But interesting enough, there were about 100 local people there, and the general consensus was sovereignty.
Mm.
Now, some people are misusing the term secession.
Right.
Secession is really an improper word because we were never part
mm-hmm.
of the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's just a reassertion of our sovereignty, not a secession.
And essentially, the reassertion is now coming because there are certain clauses and agreements made in many of these treaties that go back 150, 160 years that are now just being determined to be null and void, essentially. We're no longer going to play by those rules because you're not playing by those rules.
Yes, and the problem with those treaties is, of course, they had no enforcement provision.
Mm.
You know, most treaties today, well, for example, if you look at the Compact of Free Association, they have enforcement provisions. Some of the treaties that you'll hear about, you know, like, for example, a disarmament treaty that, you know, we had with the Soviet Union. You know, there are all enforcement provisions in those. But back then, there were no enforcement provisions, and so the United States got to do whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back at the history of the treaties with the Indians, I mean, for the most part, there's just been a history of winks and a nod and then steal the Indians' land.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't go along with it, shoot them.
Yeah.
Or starve them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. I know enough about the history of it. Let me ask you a question. You have mentioned a couple times that you were an American and now you're living in Lakota. What's required of you to do that, and can other people join in, and what's the, you know, what's in it for them?
Well, yes, you know, I mean, I say I were, but at the same time, you'll hear me speak out of the other side of my mouth and say I am. I actually have not become a citizen of Lakota. I'm here as a volunteer, and I here serving at the will of the provisional government. I certainly recognize my status as a guest. As far as what it would take for other people to come and volunteer to help us, they would have to be self-sustainable. We're not in the position where we can house and feed people. We're looking at some various places where that would make more sense for Americans to do that. And the place we're looking at most closely, and I'll probably know more later in the week, is a place called Hot Springs, South Dakota, which is about an hour south of Rapid City. Rapid City is the actual closest big city to the area, and there were some people who might find Rapid City more attractive, although it's certainly not a big, big city. About 62,000 people, and you go 10 miles outside, and you're really out in the country.
Yeah. What about the people who don't want anything, and they don't want to help, they don't want to do anything, they just want to go there and live and be left alone?
Well, again, you know, it's probably not going to be easy for them to come and be on the reservation. And if they do come, so they will have to recognize that the United States hasn't left yet, so they probably will still be subject to the United States laws and rules. But if they want to come just to be with us, yeah, the Rapid City, Hot Springs area is the area where we're inviting people to come and coalesce to be with like-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, some other people might find some other areas that they find more attractive. So, you know, it's up to them. You know, you can look on the map and kind of get a sense, but we're just southwest of Rapid City and just west of Hot Springs on the Pine Ridge Reservation, mm-hmm. and that is where the coalescence is happening.
Yeah, I've been to Pine Ridge, and I know it well. I was going to mention sometime during the program a number of people that have been very close to me over the years are from that particular area, Porcupine, and from Pine Ridge, Grandfather Wallace Black Elk, and Kanji Sapa and Grandfather Sylvester Black Crow, and there are teachers of mine and grandfathers of mine from back in Colorado in the day, but I have a deep connection to the people there and the elders, and I'm very interested and concerned and pleased and a whole bunch of things at the same time, you know, when I'm hearing the stories, and it's a pleasure to learn more about it. So, but you know, but it's also, you know, people shouldn't be Pollyanna-ish about it. I mean, if you go to Pine Ridge, if you go to South Dakota and you see the situation up there, you'll realize really quickly that this is not, you know, a paradise by any means, and there's no panacea involved, and there's a whole lot of work that has to be done up there in order to make it what we're all talking about.
Yes, for sure. But, you know, and again, that's why, you know, we're asking people to kind of come and be close together with each other. And maybe people can kind of start support groups on the Internet where they can dialogue with each other. In fact, we have a forum mm-hmm. on the Republic of Lakota website.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, somebody might, you know, want to buy an apartment building. Other people might want to rent houses, for example. Somebody might want to come build something that, you know, other people could live in. So people can kind of come together as best as they can. We're big believers in free association by free will. And the more people can do that kind of thing. And, of course, there are other people who might just want to help out from where they are. And one of the easiest things that people can do, particularly if they have Internet access or a telephone or see people, you know, in their neighborhood and the like, is to just tell people, because the press has not been covering this very much. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, how the Indian in India got written out was just by public opinion of the British people. As we get more public opinion out to the American people that this is the Lakota country and the United States is trespassing here and always has been, even though they came in, you know, dangling promises, the promises haven't lived up. It was always a charade, and it's time for them to go home now and let us have our country back.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Now, that doesn't mean the United States people. We're talking about the government.
I understand.
People are welcome to stay.
Right, okay. All right, the provisional government that's been set up that you've mentioned a couple times, could you give us a little bit of a description about what it is and how it was formed?
Sure.
And who's running it?
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, you know, what it is probably the key thing. You know, we haven't declared ourselves, you know, the junta or emperors or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see ourselves more as midwives for the rebirth of the nation. And, you know, people are asking us to make all these promises and commitments. And our position is, you know, that's really not our role. You know, once there's a more permanent government established, you know, they can make those kind of commitments. Our role at this point is to just facilitate the transition between the United States leaving and a new government being established. And who is on it? It started out with the delegates who went to Washington, and as they went around to the various reservations, they got various people from the reservation who came to the meetings and were supportive of what we're doing to appoint representatives. You know, the Lakota people do things mostly by consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like at the last meeting, there was a clear consensus for this one woman. I mean, like, there was, like, no doubt she was going to come. We were at the Yankton Reservation. She was going to get involved on, so she's now on the provisional government. There wasn't a consensus, really, for a second person.
Mm-hmm.
So we only put one person from that reservation on at this point. And as they come to a consensus on a second one, then they'll put one on. From some of the other reservations, we do have two that we've had. So it just keeps growing. And then, you know, when decisions have to be made about things, for example, when they appointed me, they had to get a consensus among the provisional government at the time to do that, and they did.
All right.
And so, you know, I'm here, and we have various people in various roles doing various things. We're recruiting more people. We have some international lawyers who are gathering teams of law students to work on our behalf. We're looking at what our options there. We're trying to put together a bank because, again, the United States has jurisdiction here. We will probably open the bank in some kind of foreign location. One of the places we're looking at is maybe Ireland.
Mm.
We ask, like, what kind of support we get. We get tremendous support from overseas. And particularly from Europe, you know, the most colonized or the longest colonized country in Europe is Ireland, and they've been very supportive of the Irish people.
Have you you mentioned a bank? So, have you considered currency and this sort of thing?
We have considered currency, and what we're most seriously looking at is a gold and silver backed currency.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I mean, that's the way this country was originally designed.
It is the way this country was originally designed, the way most of the world countries used to be until they went into the idea of print and funny money.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see a future in that.
Yeah, I that's an interesting side note altogether. You know, there's a lot of things on the plate of Washington, D.C. right now. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, what about travel and, I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head now, but, you know, things like passports and driver licenses and all the things that we've been talking about, control measures. I mean, how do you see the nation of Lakota fitting in to the rest of the world, sort of international community? I mean, you know, for people traveling to and from and this sort of thing. And if you're going to go elsewhere, for example.
Well, again, you know, it's a transitional phase right now. The United States government is still here.
Right,
I still have my U.S. passport. There are some people who have shredded and burned theirs, and, you know, they'll deal with that. But there are people who are living in all parts of the United States who've done that, too. We're not recommending anybody necessarily do that yet, although there's some people who just feel called to do that. There have been countries formed. I mean, if you look at the former Soviet Union, you know, there have been new countries emerged from it. Countries, trust territories of the Pacific have emerged, and the people have figured out how to do this. It's just a matter of, you know, bureaucrats and administrators knowing how to do it. We want to be as, you know, unbureaucratic as possible, but this is not something that is rocket science, and they're experts who will know how to do this for us. I'm sure we'll bring them in at the right time when it's necessary.
Right. So there's a lot to be done, and these are things that eventually will unfold as things move forward. So
yeah, and that's our role as the provisional government, is to gather the people to do these kind of things.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Okay. All right. We've got a few more minutes before the top of the hour. Let me ask you, and would you be willing to stick around for a little while after, maybe for another half hour at least?
You want to play some more music?
I sure will, but...
Your music is great, yeah, I'll say.
All right, well, cool. Well, let me ask you a question before we go to the break, though. Maybe we can talk for a few minutes about other tribes, other nations, and how the information and the news is affecting them, the Choctaw and the Creek and the Seminole and, you know, the Iroquois and the Cherokee, who knows who, but what sort of response are you getting from other Native peoples?
Oh, is that were we hanging for the next hour? Or anyway?
Well, we'll talk a little bit about it, and then we'll talk more after the top.
They have been incredibly supportive. In fact, Russ, it was one of the reasons Russell had to get to sleep tonight, despite the fact that he's not feeling well, is he has to leave at 6 o'clock in the morning. He's going up to the Northern Cheyenne. They want to do the same thing. As I mentioned earlier, The United States has breached its treaties with some of the other Indian tribes, too. I know that's going to be a shock to some people, but we're not the only ones. And what we're actually looking at doing is, you know, when we talk about, you know, what about people who want to come and help, we're especially inviting people from the other tribes, other nations, some call themselves tribes, some call themselves nations, that are looking at the possibility of exploring this for themselves, to come here and learn and work with us so that you can be the liaison for your tribe and to help them when they're ready to do this or are not. At least you'll have, you know, firsthand experience as to what does and doesn't work and whether you want to take any of the approaches we've tried or some other alternatives. But by having various people from various tribes here learning and working with us, we think, A, we can be more successful, and B, we can help the other tribes to be able to also be successful. Mm-hmm. That's part of what we're putting together. But again, they have to be self-sufficient too, either by being well off themselves or having enough people from their tribe take collections to be able to support them while they're here.
Okay. All right, that's a good place to take a little break, okay?
Okay, play some nice music.
Yeah, I'll do it. We're going to play, I think I'm going to play a song called, how about this one? Yeah, this is called We All Came From the Goddess, Ain't It the Truth? All right, and then we'll come back at the top of the hour with Jerry Collett, and we'll talk more about what's happening in the nation of Lakota. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, on the web at kopn.org. WOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Welcome back to the program. It is Straight Up Midnight, now on the 29th of January, 2008, if you can believe it, time just rolling right on by. Our guest tonight is Jerry Collette, and Jerry Collette, I apologize, and he is the sitting attorney general for the provisional government of the Republic of Lakota, and we're pleased to have Jerry with us tonight. Jerry, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I tell you, I've never been on a talk show with such great music.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Let's see. If you'd like, we could talk a little bit more about some of the responses from some of the other indigenous people. I'm interested also in what's going on internationally. I know you have quite a bit of support here from Native American people, but is there also support coming from overseas?
Oh, yes. Actually, the mainstream press, even overseas, is really, you know, glommed onto this. We've had several of the major newspapers from France and Italy send people here. Al Jazeera sent their English channel here. They were here for several days.
Really?
And, yeah, that's, I think, second to CNN now in worldwide audience is the Al Jazeera English channel.
I believe it. Yeah.
And they're doing, they have sort of like a, I guess, an equivalent of their 60 Minutes show. I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, a little news clip. They were doing a pretty big segment. And they spent a long time here. They actually did an interview in front of Mount Rushmore with Russell. I don't know if everybody knows about Mount Rushmore, but of course, you know, this Black Hills are the holy land for the Lakota people.
Yes.
Just like, you know, the Vatican was a man-made thing for the Catholic people and Mecca is a man-made thing for the Muslim people. Well, you know, these are indigenous people on the earth, and so the Black Hills are their holy land. And then along comes these guys to go and carve these pictures of some pretty significant Indian killers. I mean, you know, my learning of history was through the white man's school, and I didn't understand that how George Washington got to be such a famous general is before he fought the British, he killed a whole bunch of Indians. And the same is true with Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, to put these people carved into their sacred mountains is, you know, an incredible desecration of their holy land. And so when the Al Jazeera heard about that, they said, you know, can we film Russell right in front of that? You know. You can imagine how Muslim people would feel if, you know, we went and put something like Mount Rushmore into Mecca and said, well, we'll give you money back for it. Because, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but, you know, there actually was a Supreme Court case, that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court did rule that, yes, the United States did illegally take the Black Hills from the Lakota people. At that time, they called them the Sioux Nation. And the award is now up to $1.2 billion. But the Lakota people don't want the money. I mean, would Catholic people say, oh, yeah, we'll take money and you can have the Vatican? Or would the Muslim people say, yeah, you can have the money and that will give us the money and you can have Mecca? That's the way the Lakota people feel. So they haven't taken the money despite the fact that it's been, you know, getting close to now 30 years. And the money is up to $1.2 billion. They don't want the money. They want the Black Hills back. It's their holy land.
I understand. Okay.
So, yeah, you know, the international people are really recognizing this. Russian TV is coming out here. And it's just been nonsense. And the phones are always calling, like, you know, interviews, sometimes talk shows. It's Russell's doing these things morning, noon, and night. And this is, you know, one of the first times he just finally had to just take a break.
No, I understand, and I appreciate that he's in the middle of a whole lot of stuff. So, what about, okay, you mentioned the word midwife. I thought it was an interesting choice of words before the break. There are a number of my female listeners of the program that would like to talk about the status of women in the Lakota way, and maybe a little bit about the way the society is sort of structured, because there's a matriarchal, or at least more of a feminine aspect of culture for sure that is being intuited up there. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. I mean, the Lakota, like most indigenous people, do not recognize the absurdity of equality of the sexes when it comes to how we relate to one another. we're well aware that, you know, on that aspect, the women have it all over the men. And while they, you know, do as much as they can by consensus and have, you know, very, you know, equal and respectful roles towards one another, if there is a break in the consensus, the men yield to the grandmothers.
Hmm. As it should be. I always yield to mine, let me tell you. I don't know a man with a brain who doesn't yield to his grandmother. You know?
And the other thing, of course, is you probably know they have a much better extended family system
than
Americans do. The Americans, if you know, I mean, you know, the idea of nursing homes
is just
something that, you know, doesn't sit well with these people at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're much more collective caring for one another than we have in the American sort of way of life these days, at least. It seems, you know, most people live alone for the most part, and if they have a family, you know, they're lucky to have the family that they have in their home, but outside of their home there's very little extended family outside of the you know, the bloodline, and a lot of people don't even have blood relatives, you know, around where they live anymore. People are alone in many cases.
Yes, and in the Lakota tradition, there is no such thing as a distant cousin.
Right. I mentioned Grandfather Wallace before the top of the hour, but I mean, although I have a small line of Lakota actually in my own ancestry, I was not directly related to Grandfather Wallace, but I consider him my grandfather, certainly.
Yes, and I'm sure he considers you his grandson.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter because the connections are of the heart, and they see family as a heart connection, not necessarily, you know, oh, he's my second cousin, so I'm not as close to him as
twice
you.
Twice removed and blah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Uh-huh.
It's a heart connection.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing, actually, to be a part of a community like that. And it's also quite helpful if you're a family person and you have children or whatever, because the children are raised in a much more social manner. In other words, all the kids are raised by sort of all the... I mean, you have your children, certainly, and they, I think, probably defer to their parents, certainly. But there's a much more communal sort of tenor to the whole thing.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, and the children are also very respected because, I mean, when you think about it, you know, when... Have you ever held a newborn baby, Mike?
I have two children. I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, both boys, so yes.
Okay, and, you know, and think of the qualities when they were just born.
Hmm.
You know, what words come to mind to you?
Beautiful, perfect, innocent.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
And we all come into the world this way.
Yeah.
And it's only as we get socialized that we lose those qualities, and yet, you know, some of the other ones like fearful and grudgeful and resentful and, you know, all shameful and blaming, and I mean, we could go on and on. But those are all learned qualities. None of us are born with that stuff. And the Lakota recognize that, so they revere the youth and do their best they can to have them maintain that love and light and perfection that they come in with.
Yeah, I agree.
And I have to tell you, they do it quite well. I mean, when I got here, one of the very first things we did is we went to a meeting at the Rosebud Reservation where Russell and the delegates presented what they had done in Washington and answered questions from people. And that is when I was hooked. And that's when I realized, you know, I was really home here because they... heart and soul of these people, notwithstanding the generations of oppression, is still so beautiful that I'm here now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I consider this my home, and you know, I just love it here.
What's your background connection to Lakota? Did you know people up there, or did you just get interested, or
I only met Russell once in 1991 briefly at a convention, but you know, we had mutual friends, and one particular mentor of mine who actually happens to be a talk show radio host, and he does a show on religion and politics, and he met me on the Ron Paul blimp tour, and he sent me an email and said, look what Russell's doing here. I sent Russell an email, and we got in dialogue, and in Washington on the blimp tour, and I had about four different directions I could have gone that day. I could have gone up to New Hampshire for the New Hampshire primary. I could have gone down to Florida with the Ron Paul blimp. I could have stayed in Washington with some of the things I was doing. Or I could have come out here, and Russell said, I'd love you to come out here.
Ah, wonderful.
And I didn't, haven't gone back since. I've been managing the blimp legal team from here.
Huh, amazing.
Plus, well, I'm working on a project with the General Services Administration in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Their rules for being able to hold political rallies and prayer vigils at public buildings,
mm-hmm.
they've recognized pretty much would violate the First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're rewriting the regulations, and I'm collaborating with the lawyer for the General Services Administration to do that in such a way that, you know, our rights get maintained.
Right. Now, Jerry, I'm sure most people are assuming, but just for the record, you're an attorney, I guess.
Well, I'm the attorney general, but I'm actually not an admitted attorney.
Mm.
I manage attorneys.
Uh-huh.
But I call myself a paralegal, which allows me to basically do just about anything I want other than appear in court with somebody. I can't give legal advice,
mm-hmm.
but I get to manage attorneys that do that kind of thing. And even here, you know, I have attorneys that I'm overseeing on this project.
I think Russell's an attorney, actually.
Russell was admitted to the tribal court back when they did admit anybody who walked in, and they called them an attorney. Now they've changed the rules. In order to be called an attorney in a tribal court, you actually have to be a member of the United States Bar, which he doesn't want to do any more than I do.
Right, right. Another extension of that control, yeah.
Another extension of that control, exactly.
Hmm. Very interesting. All right. A lot of people have heard you mention Ron Paul a couple times. We mentioned him briefly at the beginning of the program, but since you're involved with his campaign, has he taken a position on indigenous people in general or the Lakota situation in particular?
You know, not one that I'm aware of. And just so you understand my involvement with Ron Paul, I don't actually work for the campaign. Most of the campaign.
Right, you just manage the blimp.
Yeah, and which is a grassroots effort that's funded totally separate from the campaign.
Mm-hmm, I understand, okay.
And I actually only manage the legal team of the blimp.
All right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, pull one of the blimp strings. I'm trying to get Ron on the program, and I'd love to speak with him. But I understand that you're not particularly directly connected with him right now, so... All right. Well, I think that he'd probably have good things to say about what's happening if he were able to speak about it. I'd be interested in what his position was. So,
well, I have to tell you, you know, Russell has said, you know, in fact, this was back when I first got here in December.
Russell must know Ron. They must go back from the Libertarian Party because they've both been around for a long time.
Well, like I say, in the nomination, when Ron got the nomination, he came in second
right.
to Russell by one vote.
Uh-huh,
I
uh-huh.
say that Russell came in second by one
vote. Right.
But you know, Russell had mentioned earlier, you know, back when there were a lot more candidates in the race, he said, you know, when we're ready to negotiate with the government, out of all the candidates running, because obviously the Bush administration is coming to a close soon,
mm.
he said, the two I would feel most comfortable about negotiating with and knowing that they'd honor their word would be a Paul administration or a Kucinich administration.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Dennis has now dropped out, so
all we
have left is Ron.
Right.
And, you know, he's maybe hopeful that a Barack Obama administration might, you know, deal in good faith, but it's too early to tell.
Not me. I'm from Chicago.
Yes, exactly. You know,
I know too much about his background.
Yeah, so, you know, for the most part, the Democrats have sold out the Indians in some respects worse than the Republicans.
Yeah, it's been two sides of the same coin for the most part for a couple hundred years at least, you know.
Yeah.
For 500 years, for God's sake. So.
Well, the Democrats kind of have a better PR act, like they care.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you
know, the whole left issue, you know, I don't know if you read Russell's autobiography,
mm.
but there was this whole big belief when the Sandinistas started to come to power in Nicaragua that suddenly they were going to take care of indigenous rights. And so Russell was involved very much at the time with the international indigenous movement and was involved with some of the indigenous people in Nicaragua. And when they found out that the socialists were just as bad to the indigenous people as the capitalists were, and Russell made public statements about that, suddenly he alienated the left because they didn't want to hear that the socialists were hard on the indigenous people.
Right.
In fact, you know, in Cuba, for example, Castro doesn't recognize that there's any indigenous people.
Hmm. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, all right. A couple people want to know a little bit about the reservation and the history of it and why it's even called what it is. You know, I live in Missouri here, where I'm speaking to you from,
mm-hmm.
and this is Lakota country.
Where it used to be, yes.
It used to be. So, people are interested in first of all the geography of actually what's happening up there, and maybe you could give a little bit about the actual geographic situation. I know there are five states involved. Maybe you could mention the geography of it. But what about? I mean, it seems to be the unwinding of a big thing that sort of really doesn't have a border.
Well, yes, it didn't really have a border. I mean, the tribes were, let me go back a little bit to even my history. I was born and raised in Massachusetts, and there's a lake in Massachusetts that is currently referred to mostly as Lake Manchog. But the long name of it is something more like Chagagog, Manchagagog, Chagamagagua. And what that means in the native tongue of the area, which I forget what it is in closest translation, is we'll fish on our side, you fish on your side, and nobody will fish in the middle. And that's pretty much how the local Indians throughout the country worked out their border disputes with each other. Is they would have these neutral zones that, you know, would just kind of leave it, and people could pass through them, but they each kept to their own space, and not that they didn't have skirmishes here and there,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, they were able to work it out among themselves pretty well.
Yeah, and I mean, in the latter days, I mean, people get caught up in the history of the late 1800s, you know, and by then, I mean, 90% of the indigenous population in this country had already been wiped out. I mean, then it was just people fighting for their lives, for God's sake. And you had people, you know, siding with the government. They're doing anything, essentially, to just sort of protect their own.
Oh, yeah. They herd up people from the streets and throw, you know, a half dozen of them into a 6x8 jail cell, and they fight with each other, and they say, see? Well, of course, when you crowd people in together, and the Indians got really crowded in from the white man and started fighting with each other, you know, in ways that they never really had before. The white man was crowding them out.
You know, and there's other something that maybe you could comment on that just sort of came to me. But I remember one of the first things that I was taught from my Lakota teachers and was about the idea of movement and. One of the nasty things that came out of this was the fact that even though there were these boundaries and these neutral zones and stuff, the Lakota people in particular were people that moved and they needed to move. I mean, they followed the buffalo, they followed the stars, and that was part of the way. And so when you got put on a reservation where you could no longer really move, that alone was destructive in a tremendous fashion to the people.
Oh, yeah. And it was, again, just all part of the genocide, you know, not to mention taking out all the buffalo.
Hmm.
You know, but getting back to the geographical issue, probably the easiest point of reference is the map that's on the website.
Yeah, and let's give that out again. It's Republic of Lakota, LAKOTAH. republicoflakota.com, and right on the front page there you'll see a map. Yeah,
and if you click on that map, it'll give you a bigger version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that colored section of the map represents, and that does cover into five states, left to right, or starting on the left going down, would be Montana and Wyoming, and then moving over to the right going down would be North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. That boundary there, and the only reason we used it just was a convenient map that was on the Internet and easily accessible and had some meets and bounds that we could use for some legal documents because it was previously published. Those are the 1851 treaty boundaries. But if you look at the 1851 treaty, it clearly says that the Lakota aren't giving up their rights beyond this area.
Mm.
And There was a audit done by the General Accounting Office. I think it was called something else back then, but it's whatever it's called, the General Accounting Office now, in 1932, that gave a report of over 190 million acres of land going into 11 states, and yes, Missouri was on that list that the Lakota had traditionally had as their lands. And so, you know, if you read in some of our documents, you know, we're saying we're not waiving any of our claims to our traditional lands. Our focus right now is on that area, but our special focus is on the Black Hills, because that's the one that, you know, we've clearly had the litigation on and the pronouncement from the Supreme Court that, yes, the United States clearly wrongly took it. But if the other land had been litigated as much, we expect we would have gotten a similar result, except for the fact that, you know, we don't want the money. One of the first things we want to do is we want to stop the United States government, the state governments, the municipal governments from selling off any more of the land that's held by the governments, as well as extraction rights. You know, there's talk now about taking more uranium out of the Black Hills in this area, which last time they did, of course, caused all kinds of groundwater pollution. And so, you know, we don't want any more minerals coming out. We don't want any more trees being cut down. We don't want any more digging of mines, anything like that on government-owned land. So that's the first thing we're trying to stop, is the government sell-off of any of the lands and the extraction rights.
Okay.
But as far as, you know, people who have their private houses here, you know, we're not looking to evict them. We'll probably give them a better quality of life than they would get. You know, maybe there are some people who are living off the exploitation who might think their life wouldn't be better. But, you know, it's an illusion that the oppressors don't suffer as much as the oppressed. It just doesn't show as obviously, but I really come from the perception and awareness that oppression doesn't serve anybody, even the oppressors.
Eventually not even them,
Yes, and so, you know, I'm not considering myself at all an enemy to the United States, because I'm going to stop the United States from oppressing the Lakota, just the opposite. I really think that, you know, the United States is going to be in a better situation, and the people of the United States will be much happier that they're not supporting this kind of oppression. So it'll be a win-win situation for everybody when the oppression stops.
Okay. All right, with regard to that, there's...
Oh, yes, the colors on the map.
Oh, yeah, go ahead,
Yes, that's right. So the yellow area, all those colored areas, that's the 1851 treaty boundaries. Then the orange area, if you notice, the Black Hills isn't in there. The Black Hills is kind of along the western border of South Dakota and goes over into the whole of the yellow area of that map. The Black Hills was all stolen, and that's why the Black Hills isn't in the orange area. So the orange area is what's left after the Black Hills were stolen. And then the red area is the reservations as they sit now.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And by the way, the reservation model is, in essence, what Hitler used for the concentration camps.
Yeah, just a different name for the same thing, essentially. Put them over there, put a fence around them, and then do whatever you want, essentially.
Yeah. And one of the things that Russell mentions many times is, you know, if you take a wolf and put it in a cage, that wolf will try to get out of the cage for the rest of its life.
Mm-hmm.
But if that wolf has pups in the cage, the pups won't.
Mm.
And so, you know, again, you know, we talk about how the Indians have been trained into dependence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even getting back to the concentration camps, you probably heard stories when the Allies came, particularly on the Eastern Front, and the German guards fled the concentration camps. The doors were wide open, the gates were wide open, and the prisoners stayed.
Right.
They didn't dare. They'd just gotten so indoctrinated that was their life.
Mm-hmm.
And we have kind of a similar situation here. You know, people saying, well, what are we going to do without the United States government?
Right. They're the ones that have taken care of us for all this time. Yeah.
So we definitely have some of that response.
Well, and again, it's an interesting term that you use, and I understand it a little bit better now, the idea of midwifing something through, because it is a birthing type of thing, and there is a learning curve and some pretty sensitive things, I guess, that are going to have to be dealt with if this is really for real.
Yeah, and we, of course, we use the term rebirth rather than birthing because, of course, the nation existed before.
Sure,
and that's the beautiful thing about it. It's not like we're starting from scratch.
No, no, there's a lot of great things that can be reincorporated, sure.
Yes.
All right, well, let's see. There are more questions. The question is for you. Do you want to stick around?
With you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. You got to play some music in
between? I'll play a little bit of music here, and then we'll take a 5 or 6 minute break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more. We've got questions about military. People are concerned that the government of the United States may not take this as friendly as you're hoping, and that there's talk of, you know, Waco and frightening things like Wounded Knee and this. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that when we come back. And I'm interested in education and language, too. We could talk about that a little bit, okay?
Sounds great.
And then maybe we'll open the phone lines. I don't know. We'll see. But we'll just sort of play it by ear, okay?
Sounds great.
All right, Jerry. Thanks, man. Everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, on the web at kopn.org. I'm talking to Mr. Jerry Collette, and we'll be back with him in just a few minutes. He is involved with the Republic of Lakota and a very interesting situation that's developing there in the middle of the United States of America. So we'll come back and speak more with Jerry in just a few minutes. In the meantime, here's a little bit more from Christian Bollmann and the Oberton Corps. This one is called Kuate Lina Lina Muapte. Yeah, this is a Lakota song. Beautiful stuff. It's Mike. This is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. All right, another song there from Christian Bollmann and the Oberton Corps. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It is now about 12:30 on the AM side of the 29th of January. Time rolling right along, 2008, and we've got Jerry Collette on the line with us from the Republic of Lakota, and we're going to get right back to Jerry and say hello once again.
Hey, Mike, great music.
Thanks. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Yeah, I wanted to pick out something that was sort of fitting for tonight, and I think I found it. So, all right, let's talk a little bit about children and education and language in particular. The Lakota language, like many indigenous languages, has been greatly reduced and decimated and attacked. And, you know, when genocide happens in the human sense, the language is one of the first things that goes. And I'd like to know what's happening up there with regard to the kids and education and language.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Mike. You know, first of all, when it comes to being able to express emotional feelings, spiritual states, just expressions of love, the Lakota language, and I don't know this from personal experience, it's just, you know, what I've been told from experts, is so much richer than the English language. You know, the English people weren't particularly known for having that much depth of feeling, so they didn't need that many words for it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Emotion and feeling are, we have five or six words for it in English. But yeah, the little Lakota that I do know is very, very emotionally expressive. It's beautiful, actually.
Yes, and then what happened when the colonizers came over here and insisted that they learn English, particularly during the boarding school years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it got so oppressive that, you know, if these kids spoke their language, they would be punished severely, sometimes put out in the cold, or even kids who've been known to die from being out in the cold simply because they spoke Lakota. And part of the reason they did is because there just were no English words for it. You know, people tell stories about, you know, when they're learning Lakota, if they, you know, nowadays, and they speak English, and they have to ask somebody what it means, and they're one word, and they'll get a whole paragraph answer, just because there are no English words to say what the Lakota can say in one word. But unfortunately, yes, the average fluent Lakota speaker is 65 years old. And Russell's been looking around, for example. He doesn't remember all of the words for all the different kinds of clouds. He said there's something like 55 different words for the kinds of clouds they have that, you know, describe what their weather patterns and wind patterns are. And he can't find any elders that knows those words anymore. So those words might even be lost already. And but the good news is there are strong movements to bring it back. I was just visiting a friend of Russell's yesterday, and this man is a contemporary of Russell's, or close in age. Russell, you know, says, you know, in Lakota they speak, you know, about winters. He's been alive for 69 winters. And if you've been to the winters up here, you can see they use those as the measuring device.
I was there last February. I remember well.
But this friend of Russell's was a contemporary of Russell's, and there he was with his four-year-old granddaughter. And she was speaking phenomenal Lakota.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Yes, and I think that's going to be... In fact, I turned to Russell, because Russell's been talking about the language ever since I've been here, but this is the first time I ever saw anybody at that age speaking it.
Right.
And I said to Russell, there's your solution to the language. You get the elders teaching the kids at this age the language.
Yeah.
And don't even worry about the ones in the middle. They'll get it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, again, both sides of this coin, you know, one of the main goals and one of the, you know, high points on the agenda of imperialist colonialist type agendas is to separate the generations, you know, to make sure that the people who have been around for a while and have some knowledge and wisdom don't get a chance to share that with the young people, to break those those connections between generations. And that's happened not only, you know, like we talked about earlier, the Lakota and the indigenous difficulties in general on this planet have been sort of a testing ground for ideas that have been then exported to, you know, whomever, including, you know, the middle class white bread American these days. And if you look at the children in our culture, you know, here in mid Missouri or in Chicago or in places outside of Lakota, you'll find a similar situation. Young people who have been systematically disconnected from their elders.
Oh, and look at what we do to the elders. I mean, the tragedy of the amount of wisdom that dies every year.
I know.
And even the people who don't die. I mean, what do we do with our old people? You know, we send them off into these, you know, warehouses where we, you know, have them play bingo and watch TV until they die. And, you know, it's really a tragedy that we don't respect what our elders have to give to the youth. The whole idea of retirement is just a concept that was totally foreign to the indigenous people. I mean, retire from what? Life is a pleasure.
Or so it should be, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, if you're working for IBM, you want to retire, for God's sake, right? If you had a decent life, why want to, you know, you don't want to stop that. So. All right, well, what about, what about in a formal sense? Is there a plan for schooling? I know Russell has had some of his own ideas about schooling and total immersion and this sort of thing. And I think he's taken his cues from some of the indigenous successes that have happened in New Zealand with the Maori people and some others. But is that a high priority on the agenda?
It is a high priority on the agenda culturally. But one of the things that we want to avoid here is the trap of government involvement in everything, particularly education. You know, what government education has turned out mostly to be is just a brainwashing system.
Sure,
I mean, as being raised in American school, I learned that people like Christopher Columbus, George Washington, Daniel Boone, and a whole bunch of others were heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, in fact, I mean, they were really killers who killed off the local people.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't heroes, really. And there's so much else that happens from a brainwashing point of view in government schools. And, you know, if you look at statistically, you know, how people just aren't learning in government schools. It's just places to design cogs for the military-industrial establishment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of thing that we want to create here, where it is, you know, different groups, be it, you know, private or charitable groups that want to either do it for profit or just because they care,
mm-hmm.
will create various kinds of alternative school systems that people will get to pick and choose from rather than a one-size-fits-all for everybody for the rest of their life.
Right.
And so we want to encourage creativity. We want people with innovative ways of educating people. Yes, certainly there were some ways that it was done historically, but there are also new things that have been discovered in learning theory that, you know, can be applied not only to Lakota people but elsewhere.
Sure.
We really want to be open to all of that. Yes, Russell has the Treaty Total Immersion School that he is working to create here right on the property that I'm at. I can see it out the window in the daytime here. It's a three-story prefab teepee with a 40-foot diameter. And it's pretty amazing. But right now, you know, it still needs more funding, so it hasn't gotten launched yet. He tried to do it on a part-time basis and didn't quite have what it took to really get it sustainable.
Right.
So we're ramping up to get that geared up, and ideally it will start by next September. But there are other options that we'd like to encourage people to do, but we don't want to have a Department of Education like the federal government does. If you look at the amount of money that gets spent on the school system in relation to the quality of education, it's almost inversely proportional.
Wow, Jerry, you must be reading my mind. But someone on the in the chat room right now just put up a post and said, "Ah, yes." And tonight, President Bush, of course, tonight was his State of the Union address, but this woman writes, Bush talking about the No Child Left Behind almost made me ill tonight. And I think it speaks directly to what you're talking about. The first of all, the Bush administration and the U.S. government in, you know, in their general position on what they call the Indian problem, you know, but in a general sense, you know, the indoctrination and the conditioning that is what the Department of Education is interested in, and not really teaching children. You know?
Right.
All right.
You mentioned military.
Well, yeah, you know, then, and let's get to that because, all right, there are a lot of things about this that we've talked about tonight, the whole situation with the Republic of Lakota and what it stands for, that are very attractive to many people. Certainly a person like me, I think it's great, and I'm watching very closely, and I'm, you know, trying to establish my own communication with you all, obviously, you know, because I'm interested in this from more than just a radio interview standpoint. I'm interested in it for personal reasons too, you know, and I think many people that hear this type of stuff probably will be. There's, of course, the natural question then for people to say, well, the power centers, you know, that have a history of, you know, patriarchal aggression, this sort of thing flies in the face of that. And a lot of people say, well, you know, I don't believe that power gives up anything without a struggle, and it never will. And how is it that this is going to happen without, you know, fists being launched and more dangerous things than that? And people are concerned that it may turn into another, you know, standoff type situation. What do you see there?
Well, I mean, I don't really see it as a standoff. I mean, if they show up here, you know, we do have a gate across the driveway to keep the horses from getting out.
Right, I mean, yeah, you know, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah, well, wrestle with done arm struggle.
Right,
and,
right.
And, in fact, you know, we had a situation where, you know, we tried to file some liens in their government offices, and they, of course, you know, had some issue with the filings, and so I just went and walked into the Attorney General's office in Pierre, and I was figuring, you know, I'd just deal with a flunky, and the Attorney General came out and brought me in his office, and, you know, we spoke for about 20 minutes, and I told him, I said, you know, I appreciate that you've taken the time to speak with me. Obviously, it shows that you recognize the significance of this. But, you know, I also would understand you have a lot of things to do, and if you wanted to delegate this would be fine. And sure enough, you know, that in there, you know, they got some police to investigate, you know, whether or not we're filing fraudulent liens.
Right.
And, you know, now we're dealing with the, you know, the local state's attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we just don't see that this is going to happen at the level of any kind of Waco thing. I mean, it's, you know, I think the Gandhi model of India, the Compact of Free Associations, mm-hmm. at the Trust Territories of the Pacific, is really more of a model
mm-hmm.
that this is going to make sense. And not that there won't be some people getting upset. You know, there certainly have been some yahoos back, you know, in the days of the Supreme Court case that were saying, oh, you know, if they give the Black Hills back to the Indians, I'm going to go shoot me an Indian. So, you know, not that we might not have some of that stuff going on, but for the most part, you know, we're going to keep calm, and we think that most people around will keep calm, and particularly when they find out that their life is actually going to improve under a Lakota administration than it will be under the current situation mm-hmm. of big government that they have here in the United States.
Right. I think that in many ways is sort of what it will come down to. Sort of the proof is in the pudding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like? I mean, do people enjoy it? Is it a good place to live or is it not, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, like I say, already we've been flooded with people wanting to move here and create a better life, and people wanting to invest here and start businesses here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, we have politicians who are running on platforms to get elected to various government offices for the states and national offices, trying to say that they're going to fix that, which, of course, is not what their job is supposed to be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But yet they say that because they recognize it's a problem. But what, in fact, you know, really brings people is freedom.
Right.
And, you know, what the American politicians have done is just the opposite. They think, you know, the solution to everything is more laws.
Mm-hmm.
Laws don't make you free.
That's for sure. Yeah, in fact, the excess of the lawmaking that's gone on in this country for so long has made it where everything is illegal. In other words, you can, you know, it's very difficult to walk down the street and live your life without doing something illegal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, and I guess that's by design, that way if they want to take you away, they can always come up with something, you know?
Yeah, well, that's how I ended up in law school. It wasn't because I really wanted to be an attorney. I was conducting business, had business in California, and, you know, California is so regulated, you just can't conduct business without tripping over the law.
Right.
So I figured, well, you know, I probably need to learn more about the law, and I'll go to law school, but, you know, the grand scheme of things, you know, you just don't need that much laws to do business, and
right.
Lakota people did it for a long time without having a whole bunch of laws.
Right. Okay. All right, a couple more questions, and then we'll call it an evening here at the top of the hour, okay?
Sure.
All right. I was going to ask Russell about Leonard Peltier, so I'll ask you. Is that an interest of yours, and is Leonard involved in this in any way? Or I don't even know if Russell and Leonard have any particular type of relationship, but I had it on my list, so I thought I'd ask.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Leonard Peltier's lawyer, Barry Bachrach.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, I know the name, yeah.
Yeah, Barry is working with us, and he and I have been doing some strong collaboration, but, you know, I've been so focused on what I've been focused on, I have not really gotten to deal with Leonard's issue. So I can't tell you really what the status is with Leonard or his case or with he and Russell, although I have a sense that he is still in jail.
But he's certainly paying attention to this, I'm sure.
You know, I would imagine, but I just don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Last but not least, and I'm not sure if this is one that you're going to want to grab or not, but it was certainly one that I was going to ask to Russell, so I'll pose it to you. In my own background, you know, my grandfather's always taught me that, you know, the great spirit, that Wakan Tanka Tukashila was really running the show anyway, and that nothing happens without the blessing of the great spirit, essentially. Do you get a sense of an involvement of a spiritual side of this with regard to the way things are going down there? I guess I'd just like you to riff on it if you'd like.
Well, I am, besides working in the law, I also am an interfaith pastoral counseling minister and have been for a long number of years. The guy who directed me to come out here, Bill Clade, who is a radio host, specializes in the combination of religion and government.
Mm.
And if you look on the Ron Paul Blimp website, you click on Legal Team and then click on my page, at the bottom of my page it says, you know, I invite all people, prayer groups, supporters, and church groups to join me in praying on a regular basis the following passage: for thy name's sake, lead me and guide me, from Psalms 31:3. And I use that because I have to be guided at every moment by Spirit, because I know that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more I can surrender my own will to the divine, and I really feel I was guided here, I feel it was an important piece of what's going on here for the whole world. I'm not here just for the benefit of Lakota. I'm here to serve God and humanity as best as I can at every moment. And, you know, make me an instrument of thy peace, make me an instrument of thy love. And these Lakota people have naturally the two great commandments that Jesus said. Number one, to love God with your heart and soul and mind. And they do that at every waking moment naturally. And number two, he said, was just important, to love your neighbor as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Christians showed up and think these people needed to be converted, when in fact they were already doing the two greatest commandments, even though they'd never learned about the Trinity or any of the other
right.
stuff that the missionaries tried to jam down their throats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a real spiritual component going on here, and what we have are people who could really teach the quote-unquote Christians what Jesus really meant, because these people naturally live it.
Well, all right. That's a wonderful way to finish things up, I think, Jerry.
All right. Mike, thanks for having me on, and if you're ever going to have me back again, make sure it's a show when you're going to play some more great music, and I'll be glad to come back.
I'll do it. And you mentioned a website. Do you have a website that you'd like to mention?
For now, just watch the Republic of Lakota. I know I did have the Ron Paul blimp, but, you know, that's kind of winding down.
Okay.
And I will have another one up soon, but it's not up yet.
Okay, no problem. Well, I appreciate your time, and give my best to the people there. And you have a lot of people listening and a lot of people interested and a lot of people behind you, for sure. So keep it up, and we'll keep in touch, okay?
Thanks, Mike, and keep us in your prayers.
You bet. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Everybody, that was Jerry Collette, and he's a acting attorney general for the provisional government of the Republic of Lakota. Very interesting story unfolding there in the Black Hills in the middle of the United States of America. So we will take a break here. Going to play. You know, I have an idea that I think that I'm probably going to do at top of the hour. This CD is called Earth Spirit, and it is wonderful, and it's made in a way to be heard in a continuous fashion, to hear it straight through. And so I think that what we'll do for the last hour is put on this CD from start to finish and let people sort of contemplate a little bit and think about what they've heard tonight and do whatever else they might do with some wonderful earth music. But before I do that, I will say thank you one more time to Jerry Collette, and on the web, republicoflakota.com. My apologies to the listeners if you were expecting Russell Means. I'm sorry it didn't work out tonight. We will do our best to try to get Russell on the air with us another time. We'll see how that works out. In the meantime, you know, pay attention to this story. It's an important one, you know, for a whole lot of people, perhaps. All right? Okay. Let's shift gears here a little bit and see what I normally do at the beginning of the program at the 11 o'clock hour. I will do real fast now and say thanks to everybody who makes this thing happen here at KOPN, and all the people that I share this seat with round the clock, round the week, the people that do radio here. I love you all, and you all do great stuff, and I appreciate it. So it's a pleasure to be a part of it here at KOPN, on the web at kopn.org, okay? Last week, we had Star Newland, and I want to say thank you to Star for a wonderful program, as usual, with her. And we also had great music from the Asylum Street Spankers. You can check out Star, by the way, on the web at planetpuna.com. And the music, of course, can be found on the website at mikehagan.com. Just click over on my music archives, all right, and you can find out all about the wonderful musicians that are performing on this program week in, week out, all right? If you missed the program last week, or most of the other programs, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the web, give or take one or two, at mikehagan.com. Just click over to the program archives, right? If you find one that you think might be interesting, check it out and share it with somebody else if you like it, okay? All right, hello to everybody who's been listening on the web, on the radio, in the chat room. Thanks, and it's great to be with you all, okay? We do it every week here, Monday night at 11 o'clock until 2 a.m. at KOPN, downtown Columbia, Missouri, 915 East Broadway. And you can hear us on the web once again at kopn.org. My friend Larry Noriger, thank you, Larry, for all the work you do on the website. I love you, and you're wonderful. All the people who send art, music, poetry, literature, thanks for that as well. I love sharing it with other people. If you're an artist of any type and you'd like to share your work with me or anybody else, get a hold of me, and we'll figure out a way to maybe make it available for other people, okay? On the web, we have a forum and a chat room that are always up and running, open and busy. Tonight's no different. Just click on through if you'd like to check that out, okay? All right. My email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send me email, all right? And same thing goes for the guests and musicians that are on the program. The phone number here, and maybe I'll do this. I will play a song, and I got a few more things to talk about. So maybe I'll play a piece of music and then open the phone lines. If somebody wants to talk, we can talk, and if not, then I'll put on some more of this It's more of this music, okay? Anyway, the phone number here, when we do that, right after the top of the hour here, is 573-443-8255. All right, 573-443-8255. And in the meantime, once more, Christian Bollmann, and this one is called Heyangua. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Give me a call in the next few minutes if you want to talk on the air, okay? It's Mike, once again, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Christian Bollmann from Earth Spirit on the web at www.lichthausmusic.de. You can link there from my website as well, okay? Let's see here. All right, if anybody wants to talk about anything, now's your chance. 573-443-8255, and I'd be glad to talk about anything that's on your mind. Also, while I'm waiting for the phone to ring, or not, I will tell you about what's going to happen in the next few weeks, and then we can play some more music, okay? Tonight, once again, Russell Means couldn't make it, but we had Jerry Collette, and he was nice enough to step in and did a nice job answering all the questions that I was able to put out there. So thank you to Jerry once again. And next week, we will have Boyd Graves. Dr. Boyd Graves, of course, if you are familiar with the program, you heard me interview Boyd back in August of this last year, 2007. And once again, we'll be talking about HIV and AIDS and the United States government program that developed it in the laboratory, the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. All right. And I'm confident enough to say that now without reservation. No pun intended, considering the program tonight. So Boyd Graves next week on the 4th of February. Boyd Graves, by the way, will be giving the keynote address at the Northern Illinois University Black Studies College in DeKalb, Illinois, on the 7th of February to kick off Black History Month. And he'll be talking about just this thing, and it's a big deal. So your prayers that that all goes down the way it's supposed to. All right, on the 11th of February, Brooke Medicine Eagle, a wonderful woman from a long line of healers, a friend and associate of Stephen Herod Buhner, a wonderful author and a poet and a musician, and just a really cool lady. She'll be with us on the 11th of February. And we'll have some music from Brooke as well that night, I think. On the 18th, oh, here's a cool one you guys will like, I think. John Major Jenkins. For those familiar with the whole 2012 business, you know, you'll be familiar with his name. And John has been on the program at least twice, I think three times in the last couple, 3 years. But John will be back on the air on the 18th of February, and he'll be live with me in the studio. He's actually going to be here in Columbia and staying with me for a few days down at the Shire there in Roachport. And not only will John Major Jenkins be doing a live in the studio 3-hour radio program with us on the 18th of February, the following night, which is the 19th, on Tuesday evening, John will be presenting some of his material, and he's very, very skilled at this. You know, he goes to conferences and seminars all around the planet teaching people about the Maya and about their calendrical system and their philosophy and their worldview and their history and mythology. And he's, you know, an absolute scholar. And he's got a very slick and cool presentation that he does now and again, here and there. And he's going to do that on the 19th of February here in Columbia at the Blue Fugue. So we'll have a couple, 3 hours on Tuesday night, the 19th of February, to share in an intimate setting with John Major Jenkins. So, you know, if you can get out for that, it is going to be kick-ass, trust me. And, you know, the Fugue's a pretty cool place to do that sort of thing anyway, and I'm really looking forward to it. So, all right, the 18th and 19th of February, John Major Jenkins live here in the studio with me on Monday night, and then a presentation of his material from probably 7 until 9 o'clock on Tuesday night, the 19th, at the Blue Fugue. And then from 9 until 2, you know, we just got time to casually, you know, have a beer and sit back and all talk about it. And John will be hanging out with us the whole night because he'll be staying with me at my place. So, at any rate, I'm really looking forward to it. And any of you who are interested in the work that John Jenkins has been doing for many, many years, of course, the author of Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 and Pyramid of Fire, the Galactic Alignment, a whole bunch of other things. But he's just a brilliant, brilliant writer and a scholar. I mean, just one of the most intelligent people that I've ever had the privilege and the pleasure to be able to converse with. And he's just a great, great, cool person. And, of course, another one of the Terrence connections. You know, the way that I ran into John Jenkins was because Terrence McKenna wrote the introduction to Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. I had no idea who John was. The only reason I picked up the book was because someone told me that Terrence wrote the foreword or the intro to it. And I loved the introduction, and I kept reading, and the book made the introduction look as most books should, you know, like the introduction isn't the most important part. And in that book, the introduction is not the most important part. And so anyway, long, you know, a number of years later, almost 10 years later now, John and I are friends, and he's been on the program a number of times, and you know, he shares stuff on this program that he doesn't share with anybody else. I can assure you of that. And I imagine that if he has anything interesting to say that he hasn't said to anybody else, he'll share it with us on the 18th and 19th of February. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope some of you can join us both in person at the Blue Fugue on Tuesday night and during the radio program on Monday, okay? All right, one more time, 18th and 19th of February, KJMJ, back on Radio Orbit and live here in Columbia, Missouri, okay? On the 25th, then, Richard Allen Miller, back by popular demand. I think he's the most popular guest on the program in the last year and a half or so. People can't get enough of Richard Allen Miller. So we're going to do a program on magic and alchemy, and he can speak at great depth to those topics, both of them, okay? Graham Hancock, working on getting Graham Hancock back on the program. Glenn Kimball, David Abram, and lots more in the wing, okay? So stick with me and keep on coming back, and I'll keep trying to do a decent job here for you, okay? All right. The phone is not ringing. That means people have other things on their mind. So we will play some stuff here from Earth Spirit. And I think I'll just grab some selections and sort of break in here and out. But for now, this one is called... You know what? I heard somebody cover... speaking of The Fugue, I was there earlier. You know, it was open mic night on Monday night. And I heard somebody cover The Joker, the old Steve Miller song, right? Well, here's another one for Steve Miller. This one's called Fly Like an Eagle. And it's not a cover, though. This is Christian Bowman from Earth Spirit. Steve Miller, eat your heart out. Thank you. All right, right back at you here, folks. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Once again, Christian Bollmann from Earth Spirit, and you're listening to it here. Got a few more to play for you before the end of the program here in about 40 minutes, okay? I have somebody on the line that I'll have join us in just a minute, but before I do that, I want to mention real quickly, I mentioned Grandfather Wallace Black Elk, the anniversary of his passing, the 25th of January in 2004. And he was a very, very special person to me. And if you're interested in the Lakota way, well, that's one way to learn about it. Go check out Grandfather Wallace Black Elk. He wrote one book, but it was beautiful and profound. It's called The Sacred Way of a Lakota. Anyway, Grandfather Wallace was just a remarkable person. Kent Stedman, who is another remarkable person, put a note up on the chat room that said, if I was younger and I had the energy, I'd, let me actually quote him here. If I were younger, I might make a hobby of walking across borders without permission. That's what Kent says. But Grandfather Wallace actually did that. And he had amazing stories that he would tell us about how he traveled across Europe and even into the Soviet Union back during the Cold War days. Without anything, without a passport, without a wallet, without any identification whatsoever. He would travel in traditional Lakota garb sometimes, and he went right through Brandenburger Tor in Berlin, right into East Germany, and all the guys with their commie fur hats and their AKs, surrounded him when he came out the other side, and battered him with questions and this and that. And 2 hours later, they were all sitting around him in a circle, listening to him, trying to understand what this amazing man, whose language, was one that they only knew a very little of. He was speaking English, of course, to them. But Wallace could speak a number of languages, including perfect Lakota. And anyway, he was a super special person in my own world, and my grandfather, and I love him very, very much, and I miss him every day. But, he's hanging around, and thank God that he is. And I love you, Wallace. Pila mayaye mitungashila. Ian Lundgold, speaking of the Maya, Ian Lundgold was another very interesting character in that whole story. He was born on the 26th of January, 1949. And passed away, was it last year? But anyway, Ian was a real interesting guy and did a lot of very helpful work with regard to sharing information about the Maya and the potential scenarios, some of them that are, moving towards us, the whole 2012 scenario and all that. He was a major proponent of Dr. Carl Kalaman's work, and Dr. Kalaman, of course, has been on the program here, and another very interesting fellow in this thread. So, anyway, here's to Ian Lundgold. Happy birthday. He would have been, only 59 years old he would have been yesterday, or a couple days ago, all right? So, to both of them, Grandfather Wallace Black Elk, Wambly Chikala, and Ian Lundgold. Aho, all right? Now, we have a very special guest on the phone line here who's been patient with me, Dr. John Sheliak, who was listening to the program and decided to give us a call. If you're familiar with John, well, you know who he is. If you're not, you should be. And you can get a little familiar right now. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good, Mike. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. It's been sort of a long, dark winter, and I'm still in the middle of it, but I'm holding my own and hanging on as tight as I can, I guess.
You're here.
I'm here.
It's been that way here as well.
Oh, gosh, it's been one thing after another for me. Physical this winter, it seems like. For example, tonight I have an abscessed tooth that I'm struggling with. And if people are listening closely, they'll hear me pronounce S's and these things very difficultly because it hurts every time I close my mouth. But, I hear all the violins playing out there, and I appreciate the compassion. But at any rate, just moving right along, doing the best I can.
Well, that's interesting, Mike, because I just had one of my molars pulled that was happening
a week
ago.
Oh, my God. Well, I have to have the exact same thing done. On the 7th of February, they're going to pull out one of my molars.
Yeah, I decided, you know, no root canals. And if I want a tooth there at some point, I might have an implant. But, you know, it had been going on for months, and I just finally said, you know, I got to get this out because, you know, I don't want to be dealing with this. And
well, I've had the same thing
happen. So.
Yeah, my
you
went...
get that infection out of your system, you're going to feel better.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait because, believe it or not, I even mentioned to you when you were here in Missouri in September, but I didn't realize what it was. I was having an earache and jaw problems, and I didn't know. It was sort of moving all around, and finally it localized, you know, right on this tooth, and then it's like, aha, now we know what it is. And oh, man. So anyway,
maybe we slipped into phase.
Yeah, I think so. Interesting that you've had a similar thing happen. So, well, you're hanging out in Santa Fe. At least the weather's probably a little bit warmer there. What's the winter like there?
And well, it rained all night, poured all night last night, and right tonight we have a fierce wind. In fact, I lost my connection for a few minutes.
Huh.
So I don't know what's going on, but you know, we've had a cold winter and not a lot of snow, but it's been awfully cold for a long time. It's finally started to warm up, so.
Has it been typical, or are you noticing the, you know, climate change like everybody else?
Oh, it's, you know, it's definitely not normal. What we're experiencing here is unusual for Santa Fe. Normally, we would get some cold weather, but it warms up, and it might get cold a little bit and warm up. It just stayed brutal cold, bitchin' cold. It's finally started to warm up, though, which I'm really happy about.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. What do you got on your mind? What's happening in the high tech world of John Sheliak? You got anything interesting to talk about?
Lord, everything interesting that I have to talk about. What I have to talk about tonight would be deeply personal, I think. But you know, like everyone else, and you know, we're all in the midst of major shifts. Changes, and you know, as I posted on the chat tonight, I think this culture, the economy, and political system's in a free fall right now.
Right. It does appear to be sort of coming apart.
So I think really it's really time for us to start focusing what we want to do with our lives and who we want to do it with and what we want to create. And there was a lot of chat about community on the chat tonight, and I think that's important. I mean, you know, these people aren't going to do this. I don't care who it is, Ron Paul, Obama, you know, they have their own agendas. And really, we're going to have to sort of make a decision of what we want to do, what we want to create, and go about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now is the time.
Yeah.
Sure, and I'm feeling that. I'm feeling that without a doubt. And, you know, work-wise for me, you know, funding is a major problem this year. So, you know, who knows where that's going to lead.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people are saying similar stories. I mean, the economic implications of what's happening right now, you know, in a global sense. I mean, it doesn't matter what your politics are at this point. I mean, there are major, major economic things that are occurring. They're not over the horizon anymore. I mean, these things are actually happening, and it appears to be something on that front that's also. I mean, I can't imagine the thing holding itself together for very long, you know?
Yeah, it seems very unlikely, doesn't it? I mean, you know, my hope is that what we're experiencing right now is the enzymatic dissolution of the caterpillar.
Yeah. Do me a favor and describe that, because I think that it's a great analogy, but it's also a scary one, because... You know, would the caterpillar go in willingly if the caterpillar knew that was going to happen to him before he got to turn into a butterfly, you know?
Absolutely not. In fact, his immune system goes after, you know, what are called the imaginal cells, which are the cells of the blossoming butterfly.
Isn't that a great, interesting name for those cells, the imaginal cells?
It absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the caterpillar's immune system, you know, our political system and economic system... corporate system, you know, one can see those as actually the immune system of the caterpillar. You're going after anything that looks different. You know, in fact, you know, I would argue when you talk about what happened with the native culture here, I mean, they got in the way, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what happened to them, it happens to anybody who gets in the way of this particular worldview, you know, and philosophy. So, they're not doing anything different today than they did 200 years ago.
Right.
They've become much more sophisticated about it.
Right, I agree. And but we've gotten more of a piece of it too. In other words, I think that many people get freaked out because they actually see now it's apparent to them what's happening. And perhaps it's not that much different than things that have been happening for a long, long time, but they didn't know about it. And people didn't know as much as they know. And now these things are becoming, wow, I mean, you actually know and you can see it happening and it's right in your face, like you and I were talking about earlier, you know. And so there's sort of both sides of that coin where the mask is off, you know, as far as the perpetrator goes. But the people can get a better feel for what's happening too, because they can actually see it.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, Terrence once said something about, a couple of thousand years ago, the shaman, you know, in some kind of shamanic trance journey would kind of vaguely sense this, you know, what Terrence often called as the eschaton,
mm-hmm.
this veil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're so close to it, it's palpable, you know, you know, more and more people can feel this happening. And I think, you know, we're really, as a lot of people point out, we're really lucky to be alive at this time in history,
wow.
because it's going to be, I think, turn out to be one of the most remarkable periods in human history.
Yeah.
Unlike anything that's ever happened. So.
It sure feels like it. And there are things that are happening, you know, that are on the radar that sort of confirm that, and that's why I don't really say it lightly. I think, you know, there's an argument, people say, well, everybody, you know, when they're in their own time, assumes that, you know, their time is the most special or the most unique or the most, pivotal. But I see, you know, fundamental differences between what's happening now on planet Earth and what was happening at the Renaissance or what was happening during ancient Egypt or any of the history that I know. And I've done my best, to at least get a reasonable grasp on that stuff.
Well, yeah, it is. And, you know, and the thing is, you know, when you use the metaphor of the caterpillar, we're in this enzymatic soup, in fact we are, which it often feels to me. Everything's chaos. There's no way of... There's no pattern. You can't see anything. Everything's just going every which way. You've got, you've got immune system going after, emerging cells and all of that. And
mm-hmm.
there's no way to tell where this is going. And I think this is where we are in history.
For people unfamiliar, what John is talking about in a physical sense with the caterpillar is that before the caterpillar transforms, and it literally is a transformation into a butterfly, it's not like the caterpillar grows wings. The caterpillar literally dissolves into a like a fluid, an enzymatic fluid, right, John?
Exactly.
And then it's reorganized. All of those cells and enzymes and amino acids and DNA and everything, which is programmed by the Great Spirit, for God's sake, who else could do this? And then it emerges as a completely new creature, with, and how could it be much different? You know, this is a creature that spends its life in two dimensions, crawling on the ground, and probably can't even imagine a third dimension, much less flight. And now the thing comes out of the cocoon and it literally can take wing. I think it's just it's a remarkable example of an extreme transformation, you know?
Well, it is, if you think about it. I mean, in many respects, the caterpillar is sort of confined to a really fairly small area
uh-huh.
on the planet.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole lifetime spent in a very kind of limited environment.
Yeah, one tree for the most part, you know?
Yeah, and he spends his entire lifetime, gobbling as many resources, as he can, just,
uh-huh.
Essentially as a glutton.
Yeah.
The butterfly, on the other hand, as a creature who travels lightly on the world, but is able to travel to places and environments that the caterpillar can't even imagine. If you,
mm-hmm.
If you extend that metaphor or that image, to what may be happening to us, the implications are truly extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love it, and I've always hoped, the more I learn about genetics and how little we actually know about the genetic code and and how much of it is similar to other creatures and this sort of thing, it makes me more and more comfortable with the idea that the human creature, you know, the human animal is just as potentially transformable as a caterpillar. It's just a matter of sort of perspective, you know?
Why not? Exactly. As you point out, we really don't, although we've gotten better at it, we have no clue as to what types of information, you know, is contained in the DNA. You know, I mean, you know, there could be things coded in our DNA that basically will only unfold over a period of a million years.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And maybe things that that don't show themselves until an environment sort of gooses them on, you know.
Absolutely.
That sort of thing. And the environment certainly is changing. You know, I think that's one thing that we can all agree upon. The physical environment, you know, the composition of our air, the water, the earth, the soil itself. I mean, in the cultural environment, you know, the information environment, you know, the availability. I mean, my God, think about the electromagnetic environment. You know, I mean, think about the amount of EM, you know, frequency-related energy that just pumped around this planet on a daily basis. Cell phones.
Like, it's like an ocean. It's an entirely new, different ocean, you know.
That didn't exist.
It really is an ocean of electromagnetic energy.
Right.
Sure.
And we've only had radio and television for, you know, 100 years. So, I mean, the human organism is now living in an ocean of electromagnetic energy that wasn't even there 100 years ago, you know. And so those things, you have to imagine that the organism is taking note and making plans to better cope, whatever that means, you know?
Mm-hmm. I would think so,
yeah. Well, you know, is it happening within each and every one of us or individuals, and what requires and who makes it and who doesn't? You know, these are questions that nobody knows, but it sure is.
Well, I think it's coded, you know, I once used an image of the evolutionary process. I may even mention this during one of our interviews, I don't remember, but, you know, I thought for some time that, you know, human evolutionary process or the evolutionary process in general is sort of like, can be seen much like what we think we know, you know, as crude as it might be, you know, of atomic physics. And here's how that goes. You know, we all start out in the innermost sphere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like an atom that can be receiving energy from the outside, energy comes in. And depending on, I would say, something like bandwidth, different entities, beings, individuals within that inner sphere receive and integrate energy. Some perhaps more than others.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, when one receives precisely amount of energy like the quanta in the electron, you know, that individual, that consciousness, jumps into an outer sphere or a higher orbit. Now notice that outer sphere contains the inner sphere, but also it has, as part, it has an environment entirely its own. So individuals who now reside in this outer sphere and inner sphere, you know, can talk freely with those that happen to be residents of the outer sphere and anyone in the inner sphere. But those that are still in this inner sphere have no idea of what's going on outside of that sphere. So they don't have the language, they don't know how to navigate and all of that. You know, so this, in my view, this process may continue out to infinity, you know, where, you know, the source itself exists. But, you know, I think all of this may be encoded in DNA, and, you know, depending on who knows how many factors, you know, we're able to evolve, grow, and expand in ways that I don't think we can possibly imagine yet.
Man, John, here's one that you'll like. I meant to mention it to you last time we talked. I have this book that's been on my shelf for a while that actually Terrence recommended years ago, but I never read it. I bought it, but I didn't read it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I got an email yesterday that prompted me to pull it off the shelf. It's called The I Ching and the Genetic Code. And it's a book that builds a bridge between the mathematics embedded in the I Ching and the mathematics of the, you know, of what we know about the genetic code, 64 being a primary part of both of these systems, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it is remarkable. I've only read a little bit of it, but gosh, man, has it struck a chord with me. And it's called The I Ching and the Genetic Code. It's written by a guy named Dr. Martin Schoenberger. Anyway, I just off the cuff wanted to see if you had any thoughts about that. You know, the fact that, you know, you are familiar enough with the I Ching and the work that Terence did and understand that there is some very sophisticated underlying mathematics that's involved there. And then, do you have any thoughts on whether it could be connected to the genetic business?
Well, it's my contention. I maintain that, you know, all of these things have a connection at a fundamental. I don't think it's an accident that you can find these correspondences between something like the I Ching genetic code.
Right.
I don't think that's an accident. I think basically these are clues, perhaps clues that we don't fully understand or that we can't decipher at this point. But, several people have made this connection and done some fairly sophisticated exploratory work, showing how the genetic code and the I Ching are related in fundamental ways. So there's a woman that, I can't remember her name now, that also, I think, published a book, serious writing on the correspondences between I Ching and genetic code. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about genetics, to speak with any authority about whatever connections they might have, but certainly the number of people have found that interesting, if not made it a significant part of their life's work.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well,
it's sort of trite at this point, I think, for many people.
Yeah.
But, you know, if in fact the cosmos and nature is holographic, and if in fact what we think we know about quantum entanglement is real, then, you know, everything in the known cosmos is embedded in this cosmic sea of information, which connects us, you know, everything to everywhere and every when.
Mm-hmm.
So these things are fundamentally connected, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's the work of lifetimes for people to explore these. I mean, we live in a fascinating cosmos that's just filled, teeming with mystery and wonder.
Right. I mean, you can spend a whole lifetime, like you mentioned, just on one little part of it.
Absolutely. You know, so, and there's no reason to be bored. There are all kinds of interesting, you know, paths of exploration.
That's a great slogan. There's no reason to be bored. I really like that, actually.
And I think, you know, to be bored is to be ignorant of exactly what we are, who we are, what we're part of, what's part of us.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. All right. Well, John, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for calling in. Everybody, this is John Sheliak, and on the web at John Sheliak, Sheliak, johnsheliak.com. And John's a friend and a frequent guest of the program, and we'll have to get together again sometime, John, in the next few months. You know, I mentioned, I'm not sure how much you heard, but I mentioned that John Jenkins will be here in Colombia visiting with me in February. And
17th, did you say?
Yeah, the 18th and the 19th, actually.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that you'll be able to come back certainly in June, but maybe before then. And either way, we'll do a live radio show. Maybe you can plan on staying over for a Monday, and we can get you down here to the studio.
I would love to do that. Certainly it's going to be in June. My daughter, Donna, who lives in Omaha, is going to be in Colombia next Monday.
Oh, cool.
She's driving with a friend of hers from the East Coast who is moving to Omaha.
Uh-huh.
And they're going to spend the night in Colombia, have dinner there. So I don't know who your guest is going to be, but I might prompt them or tell them to go down and say hi to you.
Yeah, she's welcome to. Have her track me down and let me know beforehand, and I'd love to, you know, introduce her to the station or whatever. I'm talking with, it's going to be sort of a, not sort of, but a very serious program. I'm talking with Boyd Graves next week, and we're going to be talking about that whole HIV AIDS business.
Yeah,
so.
Okay.
But she's welcome to introduce herself, and you know, there's a great gang down there at the Blue Fugue, and she can come down and have a drink with us or something, sir.
Yeah, I'll let her know for sure.
All right. Well, good. Thanks again for calling, and I'm glad that you're hanging in like I am, my brother.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
All right,
good to talk to you, Mike.
We'll talk soon, Jen.
Take care.
All right, everybody, Dr. John Sheliak on the web, johnsheliak.com. Wonderful guy and a brilliant mathematician and physicist, working all around, doing many, many different things over the course of his career, and certain to do more here in the future. So anyway, thanks to John for calling. Anybody else? We've got 15 minutes or so if you want to give me a call, 573-443-8255. You're welcome to. And I'll keep my eye on the phone and see what else we can talk about here real fast. You know, I didn't do space weather tonight, but I can do sort of a quick version. The sun is relatively quiet, but there's a meteorite that might whack us today. There's a pretty big meteorite that's designated TU-24, and it's supposed to come within about 1.5 lunar distances. The moon is approximately 250,000 miles away from the Earth at any given time, plus or minus. And so they call a lunar distance that particular distance. So, you know, 246,000 miles, I think, something like that. So if you have an asteroid that's passing within 1.5 lunar distances, it's pretty close. It means it's as close as the moon. And when you get that close, you know, it can be unpredictable. So, and it's pretty big. So people keeping their eyes on the skies, and, you know, we'll have to cross our fingers, and hopefully this big rock keeps moseying right on by. Now, there was another thing that I wanted to bring to your attention with regard to this space rock thing. There was a story that came out from Le Monde, which is a French news agency, a respected one, and I'll read you the translation of it here, okay? And thanks to Kent Stedman for bringing this to my attention. A meteorite is suspected to have fallen early Friday evening in Troy, south of Bourges, reported a local astronomer. The object, first described as a plane in flames, according to eyewitness reports given to Vaucluse Fire Department, was seen in the south of France before an employee of the Bourges airport, also an astronomer, confirmed the fall in Cher. Listeners called us to say that they had seen a lighted saucer overhead, reported a journalist from France, from France Blue, the local radio station. In Troy, where the population is 2,900, where the national media began to congregate Saturday morning, this meteorite is considered like a gift from heaven, a villager told Reuters. Only the French would call it a meteorite a gift from heaven. I love it. At any rate, the interesting part of the story is, of course, that a rock fell somewhere in France. But also, I like the fact that this guy says, listeners called us to say that they had seen a lighted saucer overhead. So there were, and I confirmed this, there were a bunch of different reports of this, that people, so there were two different events. There was this fireball that eventually hit the ground, and then there was a UFO event at the same time, a saucer event of some sort. So, I don't know, make of that what you will, okay? Weird things up in the skies, as always. Like I say, it's always like that. The problem is that most of us are like caterpillars. We live in a two-dimensional space. We never look up. I mean, if you look up and spend your time looking up a lot of the time, you'll see stuff you can't believe, daytime or nighttime. You just got to spend some time looking at the sky. So, anyway, what else happening in the space weather news? Well, nothing that I care to share with you, okay? In the regular news, the economy is the big thing that's on my radar. And, you know, there are red flags all over the place that, you know, that it's a dangerous, dangerous time. You know, if you're involved in monetary systems and currency exchanges or stock exchanges and, you know, all of that money casino business. I mean, that's all the stock markets that are. It's basically just a casino. It's, you know, it's legalized gambling, and you're betting on, you know, you're betting on your stocks. You place your money on IBM, and if IBM goes up, well, you know, you collect your winnings. And And if IBM goes down, well, they tell you, have a nice day and go get some more money and try again. Well, you know, in all of those types of games, they end. They don't all go on forever. And I tell you what, man, the global economic system as it stands today is a house of cards that is tall and shaken. And when it comes down, I mean, it's going to require a complete reformation of economics in a global sense, not in this country alone. I mean, I really feel it. I think it's that big of a deal. Of course, it's going to be downplayed as much as possible by, you know, the powers that be and the mainstream media and all that. But even the mainstream can't hide from what's happening in, you know, Shaker Heights, Cleveland, or, you know, Oceanfront, New Jersey, where these affluent communities are now ghost towns because the people have been foreclosed upon, or their adjustable rate mortgage, you know, went up so much that they can no longer afford the mortgage payment. The banks have come back and put fences around 6,000 square foot homes in the middle of, you know, places that 10 years ago were considered the place to be. And, you know, this is hitting home into a lot of Americans, where it finally is getting in your face. You know, when they take your home away from you, then you got to start to pay attention. And that's the way we've sort of acted as a species historically. You know, the monkeys don't tend to get too active until things get really bad. We're extremely procrastinative creatures, and you know, we procrastinate to a point that's amazing, actually, as individuals that I witness all the time, and even in my own self, and as a species. So as the pressure rises, and that's what's happening, the pressure is rising right now, action is eventually taken by individuals and then by the species as a whole. And I think we're starting to get, you know, to the crunch time of that whole scenario, because it really is hitting home. And now here in America, in the West, the last place where it hadn't hit already. I mean, we have the unique opportunity. You know, maybe that's not a good word, because it's sort of a curse as well. But we have both the blessing and the curse to be able to watch the apocalypse happen. For most people, it's already happened. You know, for 95% of the planet, Armageddon already happened. We missed it. We caused it in many cases. But now we're actually aware of it, and we get to watch it happen in our own backyard. And I'll tell you what, for some people, that's going to be very, very difficult to do. And for other people, it's going to be the most liberating thing that ever happened in their lives. It's a matter of your perspective. You know, do the coming changes, regardless of what they are, you know, and I think that, you know, most people can agree that there are changes that are coming. A lot of people see a horrific future, you know, the march of fascism continuing, and, you know, the strong arm tactics of, you know, the gangs and cabals and secret societies that have been, you know, pulling their tricks for who knows how long. More of that, or will it be something else, something, you know, different and perhaps, you know, more enjoyable and more pleasant for, you know, for a greater percentage of the people on the planet? Who knows? But there are changes coming, and they are most likely to be profound, regardless of which way they fall, you know, on the ethical or moral, you know, arguments. But I think that it will be determined by the smile or the frown on your face. You know, if the things that are coming bring a smile to your face, well, then you're in good shape. And if they don't, well, you better hang on, because you ain't going to like what's coming. All right? All right, it's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. That's my 2 cents, and I'm going to cut it there. Say goodnight to everybody, and thank you for listening to the program. As always, come on back next week. We'll have Boyd Graves. We'll talk about HIV, AIDS, and the United States Special Virus Cancer Program that I've been very interested in for the last 6 months or so. Okay, one more as we head out the door here from Christian Bollman. This is a song that is called, appropriately, We Circle Around. And it's all about circles and all about orbits and all about spin. And that's what we're doing here tonight, spinning out of here. Radio Orbit, spiral out. Take care of yourselves and come on back next week. Love y'all. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Thanks to Jerry Collette for spending time with us tonight. Thanks to John Shelyak for calling in and spending a little time as well. And to Christian Bollman for this wonderful music. Take care of yourselves, everyone.